Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the CIG Insider NJ podcast, brought to you by Capital Impact Group and Insider NJ. I am your host, Paul Krupe, and my guest today is Republican Assemblyman Ryan Peters from the 8th Legislative District in Southern New Jersey. Assemblyman Peters is one of the youngest members of the legislature and has served in the Assembly for just 1 year after he was chosen, 2 months before Election Day in 2017, to run for the seat that was to be vacated when the incumbent Assemblywoman suddenly opted to not run for re-election. Assemblyman Peters talks about his education at the United States Naval Academy and how his entire outlook for the future and perspective changed one day during his sophomore year on September 11th, 2001. He became a Navy SEAL and found himself deployed to some of the most hostile regions on the planet. He discusses how his experiences as a SEAL shape him to this day as a citizen and a public servant. He also talks about his experiences so far as a newcomer in the legislature and why it is so important for young people to get involved in politics. We taped this episode on December 14th at the Assemblyman's district office in Burlington County, coincidentally the day before he was identified by one of the political blogs as the most vulnerable Republican in the Assembly coming into the 2019 election cycle. Assemblyman Peters tells us why he revels playing the underdog, and that's exactly the position he wants to be in as he prepares to ramp up his campaign. So without further ado, here's Assemblyman Ryan Peters. All right, Assemblyman Ryan Peters, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate the time. Let's get started. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Born and raised Burlington County?
Born and raised Mount Laurel, Burlington County. Two brothers, mom, stay-at-home mom, took care of us. My dad was in the trucking business first. I think driving them, then selling them, and now he runs a leasing consulting company where he helps companies purchase vehicles. My mom is, she will be canonized, she's a saint, so she required Catholic school. So I went to Catholic school. I went to Our Lady Good Counsel Morristown and Holy Cross High School. And then I went to the Naval Academy. So for my entire life, up until I went to law school, I wore a uniform every day to school. So yeah, it's
so how did the Naval Academy come about? Did you have record of service in your
absolutely not completely by accident? Nobody in my family's in the military. I didn't give any thoughts. I was supposed to be a professional soccer player. That was my life plan for myself. And as you know, the saying, we make plans and God laughs.
Right.
So I was relatively good. But places that were recruiting me, that soccer is not a sport that gives, you know, full ride scholarships. Mm-hmm. My older brother and I are 18 months apart, so he had just gone to college. There's not a whole lot of money around. My younger brother's, you know, starting to figure out colleges. So it would have been on me. And I started looking around and said, no, I'm not taking any of these loans on. I was at my soccer team won the state championship 6 years in a row. So when we went to tournaments, college scouts would come and watch us play. So we went to a tournament. Afterwards, the soccer coach at the Naval Academy said, hey, you should come play for us. What is play for the Navy? No, I want to go to college. I mean, that's how far away I was. I had no idea what the Naval Academy was. Sent a letter to the house. My mom hid it because she didn't want me going into the military. yeah, she loves that story. Ask her about it. Even all the way up until the end, she, and probably still now, she was, you know, not my son going to the military. So I went and visited and just said, wow, this place is amazing. And
beautiful campus. I mean, the history behind it is incredible.
It's a tough place to say it's a good place to be from,
right.
Which I think is accurate. It was a rough 4 years for me. And
you were recruited to play soccer?
I was, yeah.
Did you have to get, I'm not really sure how it works, do you have to get a letter from a congressman or something?
Jim Saxton was my congressional nomination. Mm-hmm. It's just funny now being friends with him, and you just say, hey, thanks for this. Like, oh, no problem, my pleasure. It worked out. So yeah, you get a congressional nomination, so I had Congressman Jim Saxton. You have to go through all the regular processes of application, mm-hmm. and I think it's just at some point during missions, the coach gives an endorsement and says he's a recruited athlete, and then that somehow that weighs into the calculus. To be honest, I don't know, but mm-hmm. I got in, and I guess they have to pick somebody, and they picked me. And
what was that experience like?
Tough.
Yeah.
You know, I was
as a student athlete too. I'm sure.
Well, you know, and so. I was as anybody knows me from high school, I was sort of I was a punk kid from Jersey. So you know, I was the jock, and I was only good in school because I'm competitive, and I didn't want, you know, at some point. I had taken an honors English class my sophomore year, and this girl looked at me and said, "What are you doing in here? You're a jock. You're a dumb jock." Mm-hmm. And I went, "Okay, I don't know what I'm doing here either, but I'm going to get a better grade than you are." And it was more, I got grades through competition, not so much a desire for academic knowledge.
You just want to be better than everybody else.
Want to be better. And so when I walked into the Naval Academy, they two guys got right in my face and said, "From now on, the first and last words out of your mouth will be 'Sir, you got it?'" And my response was, "Yeah." And they said, the first, you know, it started getting louder and louder, the first and last words out of your mouth. Maybe the third time I said, "Oh, I get it. Sir, I got it, sir." They're like, "You're going to be in trouble here, son." And then,
not going to last long.
run away. And so it was a tough acclimation point for me, but probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Anyone who knows me or knew me in high school and then knew me after the academy, it's the greatest place for me. It was tough.
What was the turning point for you?
I think just you're around other folks who grew up differently, who see the bigger picture and just said, "Look, what an opportunity this was."
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it was a slow process for me. I think I went home for Christmas break, and I met all my old friends, and we started doing that, and it was them telling me stories about, you know, fraternities and drinking and girls, and it was no longer sort of appealing. Like, well, I'm doing something different. There is no drinking. I have a bedtime at 11. You know, I'd wake up at 6 in the morning. We would all get together every month. But first, you take a urinalysis test or drug test every Monday.
Really?
And you, oh yeah.
Wow.
I've been drug tested since I was 18. Still consistently to this day, still being in the reserves now. Mm-hmm. And then you muster, so you all get together. Then you all eat together. You come back. You go to school from 7 to 3. I was at soccer practice from 3 to 7. We'd eat, and then I'd do schoolwork from 7 to 11 and lights out at 11. Every single day. Saturday mornings, you'd wake up, you do Saturday morning training. Then there's some sort of professional development. So it's either a class in financial management, etiquette. You know, they're preparing you to be a naval officer. So if a Korean ship pulls up, you can go on board and know all of the rules and regulations of etiquette so you don't offend a country and cause an international incident.
Right.
You're training for that. And I sort of saw that and go, this is, what an opportunity. This is amazing. And I saw the alternative and didn't really like it too much. And then, of course, my sophomore year was 9/11, and then everything changed.
Wow. That must have been an interesting experience to be there when that happened.
Oh, yeah. That was, I was in physics class. I had a civilian professor, a military officer walked in, whispered in his ear. He said, "Class dismissed." We started walking back. We all live in the same building. It's called McDonough Hall. So everybody was dismissed at once. We're walking back and, you know, "Hey, what's going on? We never would be dismissed from class." "Well, I heard a Cessna hit the Pentagon." "Oh, that's weird." We get back in. There's no televisions. You don't have phones. It's the Naval Academy. You have a computer, and you can pipe in either CNN or Fox was sort of through a program. So I'd walked in. My roommate was already there. He had CNN, and I walked in and saw the second plane at the tower. We went, okay. And then for us, you know, if you're going to start a war, the next thing you do is try to kill 4,000 naval officers. And we were only a 20-minute flight from the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to hit the Pentagon, that's we're the next obvious target. So we went on DEFCON Alpha.
Basically locked down the whole campus.
Locked down everything. You know, we ate in shifts so that if they hit, because if everybody's eating together, then you can hit and kill 4,000 at once. So we all tried to stay spread out. Once they knew all planes were grounded and everything was okay, we came back up and you know, President George Bush was saying we're going to war. And
so when you enter the academy, peacetime.
Peacetime.
You know, nothing really going on. Okay. Now you're a sophomore, and I mean, your whole the scope of your future changes.
Yeah, when you're at a military institution and the president says we're going to war, he means you,
right?
And so you sort of look around and go, okay. Well, and that was the moment I wanted to be a SEAL. At that point, I had gone. You know, I didn't know what to be. Again, in my mind, I'm still a soccer player in my freshman year, and I'm feeling the call of like, wow, military service, patriotism, this is amazing. now what do I want to do? And everybody wanted to be a pilot. So I, if anybody asked, I'd say, oh, I'll be a pilot.
Top Gun kind of thing.
Why not? Yeah. I'm Maverick. Right. You're UB Goose. I'll be your wingman anytime. Right. You know, we're doing that. And so I would say a pilot. And the summer, your summers are also, you don't go home. You do, you know, you do professional development tours. So I had done, I'd gone to Panama City, Florida, and did a Navy scuba diver course that I qualified for. And then I did two other tours that summer. But I really enjoyed that one. You know, it was working out. It was underwater. Mm-hmm. They're messing with you. You're doing all these things.
And you
really,
like that.
It was. I love that. Yeah. I said, this is awesome. Yeah. I want to be a diver. And they're like, you don't want to be a diver. Like, there's diving in the Navy. Mm-hmm. It's not a, you know, there's not a big career path. And so when 9/11 happened, you know, and then they said, we're going to war. I went to my company officer. He was a lieutenant. I was a pilot. And I said, you know, how do I, we're going to war. How do I get in the front lines of the war to really find these guys who did this? And he said, well, you want to be a SEAL. Because he looked at my scuba bubble and said, you like underwater, you like working out, you like running, you like, I said, yeah, that was a great. He goes, you want to be a SEAL. So what's a SEAL? Because back in 2001,
right,
we weren't making movies and writing books every other day.
That's
it
right.
It was actually hard to figure out who we were, as we refer to in the teams as the good old days. But so he said, go find Lieutenant Shepard. He was a SEAL lieutenant at the time. Talked to him, asked some other folks. And once he described it, I said, yeah, no, that's what I want to do. And, you know, everything changed. Soccer became backseat. And, it, you know, they only choose 17 people out of the Naval Academy a year to go to SEAL training.
Wow.
Because it's a heavily enlisted community. If you have a platoon, there's 18 SEALs and one of them is an officer. So you need...
Gotcha.
Essentially, a 17-to-1 ratio.
Gotcha.
So you don't need a whole bunch.
I didn't realize. Okay.
So it's highly competitive, and you just, you got to do every, what are you supposed to do? Everything you can.
So you're doing SEAL training on top of the curriculum at Naval Academy? Or?
So I would say SEAL training, but I'm preparing myself, so, because it's not just physical, right? So I'd start waking up at 5 in the morning, go to the pool, swim laps so I can do that. I was obviously running at soccer so I could run. After soccer practice, I do pull-ups. But if you were the best physical athlete, it didn't really carry a whole lot. In fact, a lot of those guys quit my SEAL class. It was, how are your grades? Are you smart? Are you intelligent? What do you know about us? So it's like trying to figure that out because they have an interview board with a whole bunch of SEALs where they're going, what's your career path? What do you want? How would you react if? What if one of your guys did this? What's more important, the man or the mission? You're all these things, so you're trying to figure that out and answer it. And so it's the whole, you know, if you got any conduct offenses, if you honor violations, you're immediately disqualified. So there's a whole mix that went into it. So what was
the dropout rate?
So once you get selected from the Naval Academy, so 17 officers, we get spread out through the five classes for that year. And so my class, so I graduated May 28th, 2004, threw my hat in the air at the Naval Academy, got in a plane, and started SEAL training June 7th, 2004. Okay. So a couple days later, I started. So there was me, four other officers from my Naval Academy class, two officers from ROTC, and then everybody else was enlisted. We had a class of 250.
Okay.
So
six officers, did you say?
Would have
four?
Been five and then two others. So seven officers.
From the whole country?
From the whole country. Yeah. One was from Colorado, and then I can't remember what the other guy was, maybe like Purdue. Mm-hmm. And then you know, then everybody else just enlisted. Mm-hmm. I'm 18, I go to a recruiter and I say, I want to be a SEAL. They get a contract and you go.
Right.
So what about 243 and seven officers. By the end, there were 18 of us left.
Wow.
And so two of the Naval Academy officers got rolled back for medical reasons. One got dropped because he got a medical condition. One got dropped during pool week. He just couldn't handle being underwater and beating you up. And another guy, and the other officer from, I think it was Purdue, he just quit in Hell Week. He rung the bell and went away. And then the other guy got rolled for safety violations. So it was three officers, 15 enlisted. And that was, you know, so it's about a 92% on average attrition rate in SEAL training. Those who try to be SEALs and those who make it through.
And how long is the training?
9 months.
9 months.
And then there's training afterwards. You get SEAL qualification training. You get a jump school. Then you go to a platoon where it's another tryout. It's called an FNG, essentially a something new guy.
Right.
You know, you're then on trial then. If you don't do well in your platoon, they can drop you and send you back somewhere else in the Navy. So it's always working, always trying to get better, and always under some level of evaluation. Because
and for someone like you who was so competitive growing up,
this is my dream.
That's a place for you to thrive.
Yeah, I mean, the only downside is I had the greatest job in the world at age 23 or 24.
Right.
Everything else after that is fun, but never as cool. And I caught it at a great time. Like I said, we were in war, so I got all my deployments were to combat zones.
So where were you deployed?
So I went to Fallujah,
mm-hmm.
Iraq for a deployment. Came back, volunteered to go. I wanted to get to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So having gone to Iraq, I mean, it was an unbelievable deployment. And then I volunteered to go to Afghanistan because I wanted to do that based on, you know, when I was my time at the Naval Academy, September 11th. So I did a volunteer deployment to Afghanistan, came back, rejoined my platoon. Then we went to Baghdad, Iraq, for another deployment.
So this would have been 2007?
So Fallujah was like late 6.
Okay.
Afghanistan would have been like late 7. And then Baghdad was like 8-9.
So which was the more, I guess, dangerous or...
All dangerous.
Yeah.
Iraq and
Afghanistan.
The job is, we would do capture kill missions for high value mm-hmm. targets. So you would go
to
their house and get them.
Okay.
If they met the rules of engagement, you neutralize them. If they don't, you bring them back for interrogation and intelligence and go on the next operation. So there was really no safe missions.
Right.
They were just different, right?
Right.
So Iraq would be, you go out, you get a guy, and he would tell you where his dad was that night
mm-hmm.
or even on target. I mean, that's what my job was a tactical interrogator, so I would, once we cleared the house, I'd grab the high-value target if he was still there or still with us, pull him in the bathroom with an interpreter, and where's the next guy in the line mm-hmm. of operations? Where's your boss? We look different, mm-hmm. had a long beard, ponytail, you can... They talk to you quickly because
mm-hmm.
They know the guys with the beards and the different outfits.
Did you learn the language a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I could get through... the running joke is, how many languages do you know? None. Why? Because we don't get there to talk. But
right.
in reality, I could do enough in Arabic. Because again, we are a precision force. We don't mm-hmm. just go in. So if there's a guy, even if he had, if he was armed and he just kind of looks back at you, you can be like, you can talk to him and say, put your gun down or walk back to me. Different commands that we were taught so we could communicate. So it wasn't just, sometimes a guy walks in. He's got a gun because he's in Iraq. He's defending his house. He's not the guy you're looking for. There's no reason to neutralize him.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk to him. He goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. Yep, I'm done.
Right.
Puts it down, comes in. It's just the wrong guy, wrong place, wrong time.
Yep.
There's no reason to do that. So you're taught a lot of commands in order to do that. And then when I was interrogating, just by, I would say, like, what's your name? And then the interpreter would say, like, Shismik. You're like, okay, I know what to say now. So
right.
next time I would,
gotcha.
The interpreter would look at me while like, hey, are you learning Arabic? Like, no. And Afghanistan was different in the sense that like, no, we would bring a guy back and he wouldn't eat any food because it was American and they were all infidels.
Oh, is that right?
And you guys, I mean, they were, Afghanistan was true believers. Or you'd go out on a target. It was 250 clicks from the base, kilometers from the base. And this person had never seen a flashlight before. I pulled out a flashlight and they thought I was some sort of wizard. Like,
wow.
How do you have flame in your hand?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Like, you're going back.
Right. Yeah.
Back in time on
yeah.
some remote. Not, I mean, there's built up cities. Afghanistan's a beautiful country. I don't
mm-hmm.
mean to say that. I
no,
mean,
yeah.
you go out into the hinterlands
mm-hmm.
of Afghanistan to find a high value target, they don't come across people very. I mean, there's their mm-hmm. Bedouin culture. They're, they don't have iPads, put it that way.
Right, right, right.
So some of them were like, wow, you're really going back in time. And they are true believers.
Interesting.
And so you really saw in Afghanistan, you could see some stuff where you go to a village the first time and there's no women. And then the next time women are allowed to walk around, but they have coverings on.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the next time it's like, they don't need an escort. You're like, wow.
So the
you can kind of see
yeah.
culture changing when you're showing them
progressing.
Like, hey, you're taking away the people who are basically subjugating them and making their lives horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd go in and you'd pull that HVT out who was brutalizing people. And, if you cut your beard, they cut your head off. Those people, pull them out. And then the society, all of a sudden, the community is better and nobody's scared and they can come out. And, it's not all of them. It's usually just a couple of them.
Is it frustrating for you to see that we're still in Afghanistan and there's really no... I mean, the perspective for civilians is that there's... sort of no end game. There's no clear finish line for the mission there. I mean, is that kind of frustrating for you, or is it still, you know?
Oh, yeah, massively, because we're still there. I've still have friends fighting and dying in those countries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd like to see it. What's our plan for our strategic plan for victory? Mm-hmm. It's been a long
war. I mean, is there one, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You go through, I just got finished reading Bob Wilbur's book, Fear, about, the Trump White House. And there's a section there about where they developed a strategy and, where H.R. McMaster's and they're getting together and what's our, they're clearly trying to get a strategy for victory. It's just, what does that look like and where are we now?
Right.
And I think that's one of those Colin Powell, like, you break it, you buy it. We need to figure out a strategic way to get out of it.
It's been 17 years.
Of fighting and advising and doing those things. Endless wars is just not good for anybody.
Right.
I'm still in the Naval Reserve. I deploy every 5 years. I got back from my last one in 2014. I become deployment eligible in 2019, late next year. I mean, I could be going back to Afghanistan in a year. So
you just go wherever they tell you there's a need.
There's orders. Yeah. And, in other communities in the Navy, there's not so much, a need to send to deploy those. For us, there's always a need. Mm-hmm. There's always a place to go. So it's more likely that I would go. So, yeah, it's a very real possibility that in a year I find myself, or 2 years, I find myself in Afghanistan after, when I was seven. So maybe 10, 11 years mm-hmm. later, seeing it again. Like, we're still fighting this war. I'm still fighting this war.
Unbelievable.
It's very real to me.
Yeah. So your active duty ends and you come home.
Yep.
How do you kind of adjust? You go from that atmosphere in Afghanistan and Iraq to...
Well, you don't. It's a longer story, but my time on active duty... So I was leading a Ranger regiment and a SEAL regiment and a SEAL platoon in Baghdad. There was an incident where my boss got fired, so I got elevated to basically being in charge of everybody. They then took away my next tour and said, okay, your next set of orders will be in Bahrain without your wife and daughter. You're going to go after doing a deployment into Baghdad, you're going to come home, get your stuff and go to Bahrain for 18 months without your wife and daughter again. And I said, okay, thanks guys. But no thanks. And so it was more of a, because of all these mm-hmm. domino effect,
mm-hmm.
I had taken the LSATs and the GMATs prior to that deployment, always a planner, right? So mm-hmm. I had plan A, plan B, plan C, and then, three more after that. So I'd take my LSATs, my GMATs, and just said, what am I going to do next? When all those things went down, I said, hey, guys, I'm good. They said, well, what are you going to do next? And so from Baghdad, I applied to law school. My wife and I are both born and raised in Mount Laurel. So she said, you can go wherever you want to law school or business school, but I'm moving back to Mount Laurel. I said, I'll be right there with you. So Rutgers Camden.
Sounds like Rutgers is there.
So Rutgers Camden was the, and it ended up being the greatest place for me. It's such a great education.
Mm-hmm.
All the teachers, all the people, it was amazing. So I had left Baghdad in April and then did a jumpstart program that Rutgers offers where, hey, if you've been out of school for a while, we'll do a summer program. So I took contracts in May.
Okay.
So a month or two removed from Iraq, I was in a law school class with a bunch of 22-year-old recent college graduates. I showed up with a notebook. They had a computer. They mm-hmm. had Facebook. I had no idea what Facebook was.
I'm
out there.
You were off the grid for how many years? Yeah.
So, the teacher would talk. Everybody was typing. I'm writing. Going, what are we doing here? I'm in New Jersey. I'm not around my guys anymore. I don't have any friends. Mm-hmm. I have a 2-year-old daughter, I believe, at that time, maybe. There is no adjustment. It's just, we call it Charlie Mike. Continue the mission, push on. Eventually you adjust, you find your way. But based on that experience, that's why I'm, very active in nonprofits. I'm the chairman of the board of the USO, and I do, our initiative right now is, workforce development and training. So if you say you want to get out, I get you into programs that trains you, acclimates you. We have networks. You meet other veterans, establishing veteran networks at all the colleges. Building this up, I was just at the Rutgers one. Fred Davis has grown that from the year after I had gotten to Rutgers
mm-hmm.
to I think now there's over 350.
Wow.
And it's a network of
people. So the population of younger veterans around here is pretty large.
In Burlington, where I represent, I have one of the largest populations of veterans, combination of things, because I have the joint base. And
right.
So maybe, you retire and you just stay in your home there. Or it's a great place to be, so mm-hmm. why not come over here? But I think we're better now about finding each other. And then, you know, it's not like a veteran has to be around another veteran. It just helps in that transition process,
right,
to go, what do I do now? Like, I was 29 or something. I'm now, because of my service, I'm 7 years behind my peers. Mm-hmm. So while they were networking, talking to people, learning how to do whatever they're doing, I was in the Middle East, you know, getting shot at.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sort of find a way to catch up. And it's not wasted time, because the time that we're in the service is unreal. You're gaining all sorts of experiences that are valuable. And so you just need to give that veteran a chance and say, look, I'll give you a little bit of a helping hand. And then from then we're, you know, exponentially going to recover and go back up. And I think we just need to do that. And so for me, it was just finding my legs, and then I was able to sort of continue on.
And is it through that, I guess, you know, commitment to service that you started getting involved in politics a little bit?
Yeah, through another winding way of just sort of my life. I mean, I just, by the grace of God, go I. So I just try to continue work, work as hard as I can, and then success generally finds it. As they say, the only time work comes after success is in the dictionary. So for me, it was, went to law school, looked around and said, I need to be successful here. So worked really hard. And so my senior, my last year of law school, my son was born my second year of law school. So I had two children at home. My wife said, it was cost prohibitive for us to send our kids to daycare. So she stopped working. She was staying home with them. I wasn't bringing any income in. So what I started doing is I took a job at the Joint Base, McGuire-Dix Lakehurst, and I was doing defense contracting. So from about 6 in the morning to 2:30, I would train Air Force personnel going to Iraq. I teach them how to shoot, combat driving, teach them about IEDs and all sorts of stuff. So when they went over there, they were able to handle themselves. Then I would drive to Camden, and then go to class till 11 at night. Professor started seeing that. So one professor in particular, Congressman Andrews' wife, Dean Camille Andrews, who is my patron saint, of law school and helped me throughout all of it, among other folks. But she took a particular interest in me and said, hey, there's this fellowship called Eagleton Fellowship, Institute of Politics. I know your colleague, that's where I met her.
I was an Eagleton fellow, too.
Oh, you were an Eagleton fellow? No kidding. What year?
2011.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Great program. Great unbelievable.
Program. Yeah.
And again, I just amazingly lucked out. I got accepted to program. First guy I meet, Alan Rosenthal.
Yeah.
Take his class. He kind of grabs
professor.
Me and goes... Yeah. You know, in New Jersey, it's hard, especially from graduate schools, trying to recruit Republicans. So he looked around and said, you're one of the two Republicans in this whole cohort of 30.
Yeah, I was one of those two in 2011.
Were you really? Yeah. Nice. So I think I'm in 2012. I think might have been my Eagleton class. And so he took me under his wing. He started introducing me to folks.
Mm-hmm.
The Dale Florios, the Bill Laytons, the Glenn Paulsons, all these folks just saying, you need to meet this guy. And he was just unbelievable to me. May he rest in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that, I got exposed to a bunch of folks. And they said, hey, you should get into this. I said, look, as a SEAL, we're silent professionals. We don't go out in front. We don't talk about our actions. We just go out and we do things. Silent professional. And no. So they asked. I said, hey, would you consider? At the time, I was living in Mount Laurel. I said, would you consider running for the Assembly in the 7th? And I'm like, I'm honored. Thank you. How do you say no when someone asks you that?
Mm-hmm.
And then luckily I got orders to deploy again. So I got recalled to reserves. Yeah. I deployed for 14 months, Central America, did counter-narcotic terrorism missions down there with a SEAL platoon. And so I said, I really could excuse of why I wasn't going to run against my now good friend, Troy Singleton, and Herb Conaway in the 7th for Assembly. I come back and I'm sitting at home. I come back from deployment, reacclimating with my kids. I have three now. The youngest left when he was 2 months old. So I've been gone for 14. He has no idea who I am. So I'm meeting all them. We're talking, and I get a text from the county chair that says, "Hey, look, there's this guy who they picked to run for freeholder. He can't anymore. Would you be a freeholder?" So what the heck's a freeholder?
Right.
Went to my boss, my wife, and said, hey, I think this is probably a little better than the 7th. Now I know what it is. It's pretty cool. Would you mind? She said, no, not at all. So I ran. I'm pretty sure I was supposed to lose. Kate Gibbs and I We won, and you know, it was a good campaign. Joanne Schwartz, she's now a clerk in Burlington County, and Judge Belgard is now a judge in Burlington County. Good campaign on the issues. We happened to get the better end, but they ran a great campaign. Did that for a while and loved it. And sort of now what is politics for me is it's public service. It doesn't, you know, I have a job. I'm still in the reserves. I do community service. I'm on three nonprofit boards, three kids. I run the practice every night. Public service right now and being elected official is my way of giving back.
Mm-hmm.
And the Naval Academy is about a $300,000 education
that
I didn't pay for. Taxpayers did. And then I went out and I was in the military, which paid my salary and did all these paid by taxpayers. So in my mind, I have to continue to give back and we'll have to repay that. And I'll be paying that off for the rest of my life. But public service and being elected official is one way that I do that and say, look, I was a punk kid from Jersey. You trained me. You gave me all these leadership skills. You gave me these experiences. You taught me all this free academics and learning that I have, and I can contribute. How selfish would that be to just go out and make that money in the private sector? I can go out and I can contribute and help. I did in the county. We came up with creative solutions for shared services. You know, now as an assemblyman, we're doing, you know, lower tax programs, and it's about going and touching the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's never about the title or going to Trenton and saying, well, I'm going to spend all my time in Trenton. No, I spend my time in my districts, talking to my constituents, going to see them. One of the things we did a town hall tour. So I went to all 20 of my districts to their town hall meetings, their council meetings, talked to their mayor, talked to their council. And you know the people who show up at those meetings, they're generally the most informed and active.
Yep.
Leave my card every single moment. You got an issue, call me. Call my office. We'll do something. And you get out and people know how to reach you. I mean, I would hazard a guess 90% of the people don't know who Craig Coughlin is in New Jersey.
Yep.
So if that's the case, they certainly don't know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my mission to get out in my district so that you know, hey, you know, what is it? What, when I was a freeholder, half the time I spent as a freeholder explaining what a freeholder was and what it did. As an assemblyman going, okay, what is an assemblyman? And we're, okay, no, I'm this, I'm your representative, and this is what I can handle. Call me, let's do it. And some of the legislation is bearing out in that way. People actually calling now and go, hey, I got an idea. Like, absolutely. She was the constituent, she suffered from seizures. And if in New Jersey, if you have a seizure, and probably not a bad policy, that you can't drive for a certain period of time until you can get a note from a doctor that says, we've changed the medication, he or she is under control, they will not have an episode while driving. But then, so they'll suspend your license. Then when you go to get reinstated, you have to pay the fee again. So every time, it's $100 to keep redoing that. So we're putting in legislation now based on her response. Yeah, that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. You know, government's not always the answer, but sometimes when we can remove regulations.
Practical solutions. To people's problems.
Not so much making laws and making more things, but taking away some unintended consequences or taking away some laws that didn't make sense. Where you're going, well, yeah, if you had a suspended license, you come back in. Maybe that works if you made a mistake and you were, you know, driving under influence or you did something wrong. Maybe there's a little bit of punishment there. But, you know, if you have a medical condition, something happens, you then fix that condition, you go back, why are you paying that fee again?
Right.
So we're putting those things up completely based on constituent response of getting out in the district. What do we do? Talk to these people. And, you know, I'm a big fan, again, of, you know, and I think George H.W. Bush was the man for me that proved this out. And you read his history, is he developed relationships before he needed them. So I don't want to be the guy reaching out to a mayor when I have an issue and saying, hey, this and this happened.
Mm-hmm.
I need a favor. Oh, by the way, I'm Assemblyman Ryan Peters. Good to meet you. Like,
right.
Where were you? Hey, son, where were you, you know, 6 months ago when I had a state issue and I couldn't get a left-hand turn signal here? You never answered my calls. Well, yeah, well, I need something now. So help me. It's getting out. Hey, mayor, this is who I am. I'm on your turf. I'm here to see you. Any constituents have any issues? They come to you at these town meetings. Call me.
Mm-hmm.
Have government job will work.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a really interesting year in Trenton.
I mean, it's only been a year, it seems like.
Yes. You know, with all the things we're doing, minimum wage, marijuana, undoing all of Chris Christie stuff, it's been a busy year.
Did you have any kind of preconceived notions coming into the assembly that didn't turn out to be correct? Or how was your introduction to it?
I don't see preconceived notion, but I'll say this. I thought it was going to be a little more contentious. So in the sense that So I came from Burlington County. We had a 5-0 freeholder board. Mm-hmm. When Kate Gibbs and I had won, we'd taken out the two Democrats. So it was all Republicans. So very collegial this. But then you read the news and it's, well, down in Congress this and Trenton fights and this and all. You know, the joke people would say was, thank goodness you've been in all those hostile environments and wars because you're about to go in another one in Trenton. You're like, oh, man, maybe, you know, Lou Greenwald's going to come up and, like, get in my face day one and say, hey, son, like, welcome to the jungle. Like, right. Here we go. And, you know, Prieto and Coughlin are going to, like, body slam me and, like, we're going to go into the WWF. Just by the way people talk and things like that. And you walk in. It's like, I mean, hey, how you doing? Mm-hmm. I'm Craig. Like, hi, speaker. Hey, you know, Lou, what's going on? Oh, yeah, how's your family? How's this? What are you guys doing? What's up with the kids? You know, a lot of the staffers in the legislature are Eagleton fellows that I went to law school with. Mm-hmm. So I see them all the time. We say hi. We go back and forth. You know, they'll call me. Hey, we're looking for bipartisan support on things. Is this something you'd be interested in? We're all friends.
Yeah.
And that was really refreshing and good to see there. We are going to have our differences, right? Most of the time, we get in really good debates. If they know the issue and I know the issue, we can go back and forth, and it's a good time. You know, touche, spars back and forth, which is fun and whatever they like. So I would say that as far as Trenton is preconceived notions are that somehow we're up there and there's a battle royale. There's certain strong conversations and debates for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm no wilting flower. But it's not, it's, you know, after it's over, it's, hey, we're friends. And, you know, like I said, you know, Troy Singleton, good friend, Herb Conaway, was just with Carol Murphy last night. Mm-hmm. You know, we go out, we're all in the same places. So it doesn't serve us right to just ignore each other and talk. So, you know, you go out, hey, how's this? You know, we know each other's spouses and family because we're all out together. So
yeah.
It's been really good.
So, since you left the freeholder board, this past election, it changed over to Democratic control. And it seems like the blue wave specifically hit South Jersey pretty hard. How are you gauging your reelection chances coming up this year? You're going to be in a reelection year.
Right.
Do you sense kind of there's a tide shifting in Burlington County?
I don't think so. I think that's a lot of perception. I mean, I think just yesterday I read in the New Jersey Globe, there's, you know, it's funny now, you read the news and I see a picture of my face.
There's a giant picture of your head.
Picture of my head. Yeah. Battleground 2019 is in the 8th District. And I think what the blue wave, quote unquote, happened was a lot of things going on way, way, way above. It's people going, you know what, I don't like Trump's tweets, so I'm going to go way down to the freeholders who have kept taxes low for years, and I'm going to do this. And I think all in the municipalities, same thing. They came out and just went all down a side. And then they look at my reelection and they go, well, you barely won the last one. I mean, I joined the ticket 60 days before, so didn't really have much of a campaign. And another interesting time. And the county didn't go your way in a basically an anti-Trump sentiment, I think, in South Jersey. Mm-hmm. Ergo, you're going to be the most vulnerable. Completely discounting that someone's just going to walk in and go, Democrat again. And so I think long story is I really like my chances. I've been going out and talking to everybody, being responsive to my constituents. So I think all politics is local. I think they're going to go out and they're going to see that – hey, this is the guy that, you know, he's not out tweeting and doing whatever I dislike. He's out there helping. He's doing this. Mm-hmm. I don't mind coming over and, you know, and voting for him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I see why the speculation is that I don't stand a chance. But, you know, in my mind, personally, who wants a cakewalk? I want things to be hard. I want things to be difficult. You know, I'm a SEAL. I was a litigator. I like a good fight. I'm glad. If Battleground 2019 is an LDA, bring it. This is awesome. We're going to run a clean campaign. I'll probably be friendly with whoever they put up. And, you know, no matter how it goes, I will continue on. I will either be in the legislature, continue my fight to lower taxes. And the other part is I don't see how, as a Democrat, you would want more more Democrats. There's already 52. They've got 11 more than they need for any bill. Even some Democrats, I won't say their names, privately come up and go, I miss the days where there were 42 of us because our votes mattered.
Right.
If you had three or four people in the Democratic caucus who just philosophically opposed to something, they had to come over to us and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And now they don't. They know that between all the excesses, they can give their five most vulnerable, names unmentioned, also friends, who I've done legislation with, they get a pass on every bill. Hey, we're going to raise taxes. They get to vote no,
mm-hmm.
so they can go back and win.
Right.
And they can still, and the people who are completely safe and do whatever they want because these districts, they get to vote yes and we move on with life. Why would anybody, Democrat, Republican, Independent, want more of that? Because it's just going to be less government, less rationality, one-party rule, one idea goes. Not to say we have all the answers or they have all the answers. We both don't. And I think that's, I spoke at the Veterans Chamber of Commerce, and I said, look, why should we have more veterans in legislatures? Why should we have more veterans businesses? Because we fought together. Maybe through being in the platoon hut for a while, you figure out where someone's leanings are, whether, you learn everything about someone. They're Jewish, they're Christian, they're Muslim, they're Democrat, they're Republican, they're single parents, poor, rich, whatever else. We came from everywhere. And then when we went out and fought together, it didn't matter. We didn't go, oh, okay, hey, Republicans in the back, Democrats in the front.
Mm-hmm.
It was, let's go out as Americans.
Yeah.
So, my closing speech, and I think it's going to just be my tagline from here out, because I really do believe in it, is there's no longer the party of red and the party of the blue. What we need now is the party of red, white, and blue. We need Americans to come up and say, this is what we should do for New Jersey.
This has been an awesome conversation.
Oh, no, thanks.
Thank you so much. I like to finish with something called Fast Five.
Uh-oh.
Five random questions.
Blue.
Yeah. favorite movie dealing with the military, war movie, movie about soldiers.
Man, this is going to be, see, Fast Five doesn't work for you. Favorite movie is Braveheart. I don't watch too many military movies.
Well, it's kind of
movies.
A war movie, Braveheart.
Yeah, well, there you go. Then we'll do Braveheart.
Okay.
But now that it's almost like if you're a lawyer, you don't watch Law and Order because you're like, it's so fake. A lot of the military movies are just like not real.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't watch a ton of those. Probably Saving Private Ryan would be one of my war movies. Saving Private Ryan and Braveheart would be my two favorite movies.
What's the one book that probably made the greatest impact on your life?
Wow. Who Moved My Cheese?
Yeah, sure.
It's like a 12-page book.
It's an important lesson.
But there's a lot
for coping and
and figuring out of, don't get fat and happy. Don't come into this office, go, I'm an assemblyman now, and here we go. It's how I live my life. If you're not growing, you're shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
So from day one, as soon as I came in here, I was out. So I don't was it Scrap and Scurry and Who Moved My Cheese? It's been a bit. But I didn't sit on this cheese. I'm still running the maze, so.
See, that's how we know you have little kids. You're reading these stories.
There you go, yeah. And they do, my daughter, she's 10, and, it's the problem of being my daughter is it's like, Who Moved My Cheese? So she has the Who Moved My Cheese insert that comes with it up on her little desk.
Yeah.
And so she knows the principles, but. Yeah, I don't know if it's a book so much as a small guide, but I think when Who Moved My Cheese, it sort of resonated with me of like, yeah, this is what I've been feeling. Is you don't just run around and go, I've passed the bar, I've made it. Like, no, there's lawyers for 30 years who are still learning things. Who am I to say I passed the bar? I'm an attorney now. Like, now I can just sit back and do nothing. So, as they say, success just means now you can achieve at one level higher. And I think that's it was always sort of my mantra in the way I do. But Who Moved My Cheese is the book that sort of put that and goes, yep, that's my illustration of that belief.
What's your favorite sports team?
Team? Oof. I'm a Philadelphia fan, so I'm down here in South Jersey. So we'd go with Phillies, Flyers, Eagles.
The whole gamut.
The whole gamut. And then my brother-in-law, he plays in the NBA. So the,
oh, really?
So whatever team he's playing for, which currently is the Milwaukee Bucks. Just got traded last week. So it's Jason Smith. He was Philadelphia Sixer, which is where he met my sister-in-law. And they've moved a bunch of teams now. He was with the Wizards. So Wizards were a team I followed. And now he'll be with the Greek Freak out in the Milwaukee Bucks. And I look forward
Dante
to
Dante DiVincenzo.
Yes.
Wildcat.
Absolutely. Yeah. There you go. That's right. That's right. So Phillies teams, and then wherever my brother-in-law happens to be playing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I don't know how many questions we're up to.
That's three.
What's a New Year's resolution?
Oof. See, this, my wife actually had this conversation. This is not the Fast Five, and Woodsy knows this because we do this, but we're going to do more races. So Woodsy and I, you know, he...
My staffer.
Brian Woods. Sorry, Brian Woods, staffer here. We go out, and if anyone invites, it's part of the going out in constituent relations to do anything. If you invite me to the opening of an envelope, and if it doesn't conflict with my schedule, I will be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have tested that and invited me. You know, Rancocas Valley High School has the Devil Dash, which is, you know, raises money for veterans. It's a 2-mile obstacle course. I'm in. Running, sliding through mud, and I bring Woodsy with me. The Gold Star Mothers have a... How far was that, Woods?
10K. It was a little over 6 miles.
So 6-mile ruck run, which is 30 pounds?
Yeah,
30 pounds on your backpack. And then you run with a team. So it was team Peters and Woods. We ran 7 miles together with a rucksack on our back. And just getting out of the community. So we'll probably look for do a couple more of those. Maybe next year won't be the best year just with everything else going on. But I like to have some sort of race in the community to bring folks together. Again, the collegiality. When you're doing something physical, it's hard to, you know, really go, well, Democrat, Republican, and this. And as they say, it's hard to hate up close. So if you get there, your community out there, you sort of get out there, do something. So my resolution will be to get Woodsy involved in a couple more races and try to set up our own.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right, last question.
Sure.
You're a young guy. There seems to be kind of a youth movement in the legislature. There's a few millennials in the legislature. What do you say to young kids who maybe are apathetic about politics or have no interest in it?
Get in the arena.
Yeah.
And I battled that myself. My law school classmates, my friends would go, ugh, like, you want to be a politician? You want to be a dirty politician? You want to... And still now, and it's all in good fun when they're like, oh yeah, here's the politician, where's the bag of cash? Like, that's the
right.
That is the view we have,
our stereotype.
Yeah. Thank you for our politicians. So you know what? How that continues is you sit in the sidelines and you vote for the same people every time to do that, or you say, change starts with me. I'm going to get involved, and then you say, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to talk like. The other millennials, Bob Andrewjack, Raj Mukherjee, like the younger guys in there, we sit around and talk and it's like, yeah, these are the issues affecting us.
Mm-hmm.
We have real things that we talk about. Like, you know, they talk about marijuana now in the legislature. You want to have a hilarious debate with these 80-year-old senators on both sides of the aisle talking about marijuana. I mean, it was the, what do they call it, the crazy cannabis or the, what was the... you know, back in the 60s, where they talk about, you know, the
reefer madness.
Thank you. They're still, that's the era of reefer madness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to say that I'm going to be pro recreational marijuana, but, you know, when we sit around and we're saying, like, look, guys,
you have that perspective.
Yeah, they're not getting it. They're not, you know, they'll say, oh, you know what? They're selling marijuana on the corner. Who's selling marijuana on the corner? Nobody is. You know, they're selling opioids and prescription medication. Yeah. That is our generation.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's ordering marijuana in oils to their vape pen offline.
Yeah.
Whereas you have these biases from the older generations of reefer madness, and, you know, you get a different perspective.
Yeah.
So we can sit down with them, and the millennials will come to you and go, what is going on? Why is an 80-year-old man, you know, defining what I can do? It's because nobody else is getting involved, and you can just continue to vote for the same people. So what I say to people, everybody, Democrats included, when I go back to Eagleton and I speak again, a lot of Democrats there, I tell them, get involved.
Yeah.
Get involved. So Democrat, Republican, get involved. And let's have a good debate. Let's have the best candidates come up. Cause you know what results from that? Good government.
This has been a great conversation.
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me.
Good luck next year. Yeah. And we'll see you soon.
Thanks.
Someone Ryan Peters. Thank you.